Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is special coverage from WBUR in Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. It's in the mail, literally. Anthrax has taken the lives of two postal workers in Washington, an elderly woman in Connecticut, a photo editor in Florida, and a hospital worker in New York. And now there's talk of vaccinating 3,000 postal workers. In this hour, we'll take a closer look at the post office post 9/11. What message is the government sending to postal workers and to the public? First, the hunt for Osama bin Laden. I spoke with Philip Smucker, a reporter with the Christian Science Monitor in Tora Bora, Afghanistan, and asked him about the latest developments.
There was a bit of backtracking. They were saying, in fact, today that Al-Qaeda is out of food, they're exhausted, but they weren't denying that they're up in the hills. In fact, they are up there, and we heard a bit of gunfire. The Americans have kept the bombing. Obviously, they're not convinced that Al-Qaeda is finished.
And Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld said that there could be an Al-Qaeda presence in Afghanistan for some time, did he not?
I believe the Pentagon is starting to realize that these chaps can disperse quickly and move across mountain passes. Tora Bora, of course, was never a real siege of any sort. People moved in and out. Bin Laden moved down once to Kandahar, came back, left another time in the direction of Parachinar. Who knows where he is now? He might have doubled back into Afghanistan. But certainly movement in those mountains is not blocked in any way.
Of course, it was described often in the U.S. as a siege. Why wasn't it a successful containment of the Al-Qaeda forces there?
Well, I suspect you would have needed 5,000 heavily armed Western troops to block the mountain passes, and there was no will or political will to do that. There were the Mujahideen, who were not really interested in our war in the same way we are. They have different goals and interests. They've said the Al-Qaeda is finished, but obviously they're not. This is a three-day feast at the end of Ramadan that we're experiencing now. They could be wanting to take a little break.
Does this indicate that, in fact, we might be up against an ongoing guerrilla war against the Al-Qaeda in this region, or is the morale essentially broken? Do we have any way of knowing?
Well, apparently, from the Saudi financier that the monitor spoke to last week, we gathered that the will had been quite shattered. It was described as a nightmare inside Tora Bora. When they get outside, if they get aid and comfort from people and they have money, they might do better as a dispersed group fighting a guerrilla war. Although the number of Arabs has always been limited in terms of total numbers, and one wonders if they would really want to fight a guerrilla war in Afghanistan. Why not regroup outside, maybe in another country, and continue with their terrorist activities on an international level? So maybe the will is related to their political goals as well.
What's your sense of the effectiveness of U.S. Special Forces who have been supporting the Afghan troops over the last couple of weeks there? Have they been effective?
I don't believe they've been effective. We know that Al-Qaeda has been slipping out. There was a suggestion of a siege. It never happened. I think that what you need for a battle like this is to say, well, if you have intelligence and you know where bin Laden is, and I think we could have had that intelligence 3 weeks ago, you surround them with the numbers, overwhelming numbers in the mountains. These people are not going to shoot us in the back. The Mujahideen are working with us. They're our friends. It could have been done. I suppose that people might say in retrospect, if bin Laden isn't caught in the next month or two, that this was an opportunity that slipped away.
And what of bin Laden himself? Now there is inevitably a mystery. He could be buried in the caves under the destruction of the bombings, or he could be out and free somewhere.
There was a radio intercept 10, 11, 12 days ago that I believe was the same communication that this Saudi financier Abu Jafar told us about in a safe house. In other words, he said that bin Laden, after he left, had called back into Tora Bora and told the people there that he was sending in his son. That would suggest that bin Laden is alive and well. He probably didn't go back into Tora Bora during the worst of the bombing, and he probably is somewhere up in the White Mountains, maybe over in Pakistan or further south in Afghanistan, if he didn't, in fact, already get on a boat to to Yemen or Somalia.
So you're sticking with your story that Osama bin Laden has actually been out of Tora Bora for days.
We had a story last week that he'd been out for 10 days. I think it's pretty clear that he flew the coop, so to speak, and he left for good. There were exit routes, though, that no doubt he could have made it into Pakistan. The question is if he maybe doubled back and came back into Afghanistan.
Philip Smucker, do you have any sense of how the pursuit of bin Laden will proceed if, in fact, it's come to be believed that he hasn't been trapped, killed, or buried? What's the pursuit constituted of now?
It's a much more difficult game now because you might have been able to surround Tora Bora with overwhelming force, but now when you have no intelligence or poor intelligence in these vast mountain regions, the ability to send in a large number of troops is difficult because you're going to have to fight the same war they're fighting, which is probably in a guerrilla context, and do a lot of searching, a lot of looking indoors, door to door. Obviously, you want people working for you. Mujahideen can be very helpful, but it has to be, I think, better coordinated than the siege or the so-called siege of Tora Bora.
And finally, what about the famous caves at Tora Bora themselves? Will troops be sent in to search every nook and cranny of the cave complex there?
Well, apparently that's why we were kept out today, because they had promised us a tour of the caves. The U.S. Special Forces were going through caves. They were also interrogating some of the Al-Qaeda prisoners who were taking. And they've had a lot of work on their hands. One wonders if any other special units are up elsewhere in the White Mountains now looking for bin Laden as we speak.
Philip Smucker reports for the Christian Science Monitor. He spoke to us from Tora Bora. The challenge is huge, and the holidays only make it bigger. The U.S. Postal Service was turned into a weapon this fall, and the problem isn't solved yet. With no return address, the perpetrators of anthrax crimes remain at large, and the American public remains at risk. Will it ever be possible, be economical, to ensure mail safety? Should all mail be irradiated? Are you giving your postman a bigger tip this year? Would you pay more for postage to ensure safety? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. Joining me in the studio tonight is Gene Gilman, a senior fellow at MIT's Security Studies Program and a professor of sociology at Boston College. She's also the author of Anthrax, The Investigation of a Deadly Outbreak. Good evening, Professor Gilman.
Good evening.
Thanks for being with us. So you know a lot about anthrax. You've studied it in the Soviet Union, former Soviet Union, and looked at it here in the States. You've watched the news with all the rest of us this fall. What is the challenge that the U.S. Postal Service is facing right now?
Well, the challenge the Postal Service is facing right now depends on the risk, and the risk itself of more anthrax getting into the system depends on who has access to that highly weaponized form, because what we're confronting here is not the ordinary anthrax out in the field, which we know is the natural form. We're talking about a highly weaponized form. And so the whole question is going to turn on who has access to that, who then wants to use it again, let's say, in a copycat manner.
What distinguishes the highly weaponized form, and why does that have such a big impact on the risk that the Postal Service faces?
The highly weaponized form has spores that are floatable. They're floating. Which is not what you find in nature. The spores in nature tend to clump together. If you think about what caviar looks like or jam, they clump together. But in this very highly weaponized form, in a way that I think has astonished even people who know about the weaponized form, it has proven to be highly floatable. It floats. It almost springs up into the air, which is something that people had not calculated.
Is that why they're having such difficulty, for example, cleaning up the Hart office building in Washington where the Senate is? We read today that they've closed down their second attempt at fumigating. The mechanics didn't work somehow, and it's been closed for 2 months already. You'd think they could go in and clean it up. Is it this floatability you talk about that makes it so difficult?
Yes, because the floatability has led to the dispersal. And once it disperses in this very, very fine powder and then basically lands on some surface, which it did also down in Florida, by the way, it has this capacity, again, very highly weaponized.
So what's the challenge for the U.S. Postal Service?
right now that weaponized form is in the system. If more should come in, and we cannot assume that it won't, what is the challenge that the Postal Service faces?
Well, I think everyone's hope is that this is a very singular incident, that there is not a lot of this stuff around, that it was taken from some laboratory somewhere and perhaps even sent out in these strange attacks as a kind of warning to make us understand that weaponizing a disease is a very, very dangerous thing to do. So we're hoping for that, but
we do hope that's true.
But we're always hoping for that,
but
if it's not true, there are going to be real difficulties in terms of protecting the people. And I think we have to think about protecting the people who work in this system first of all, and that's going to mean something to do with the handling of mail and some of the filtration of buildings, a lot of things.
Well, talk to us just about the physics or mechanics of this. In the weaponized form, the anthrax spores are very, very fine, very small. They can escape from a sealed envelope even? Do they go through paper or through the cracks in the envelope? How do they actually get into the sorting machinery and then into the air?
Well, what we saw down in the Brentwood facility in particular...
This is the one in Washington that sorts Capitol Hill's mail.
Right, outside Washington, was that the pressure exerted by the sorting machine was sufficient to blow the anthrax spores through the cracks in the envelope. Now, I don't think anybody ever believed it went through paper, but certainly did go through those little ends at either end of the envelope.
Right.
And that created an enormous problem, as we saw.
If there are spores in an envelope, is it actually... is it dribbling anthrax out all along its path through the postal system, or is it just when it goes through the mechanical pressure of a sorting machine?
Well, I think what we saw was that it was going throughout that area and blowing out in that area. But in the Hart Building, and I think even down in Florida, there was much greater dispersal than had been counted on. So there is a kind of wonderment here about the stuff actually floating up in the air and getting in on different surfaces and getting into different rooms.
So as you describe it, there's more than one challenge here. It's not, first of all, we need to kill the anthrax that gets into an envelope, but then also filter the air, because at any point it can be escaping an envelope. So there's talk about, for example, irradiating the mail. And that would kill the anthrax?
Yes, that would. That's one approach.
Right? And how would that actually work? You just put it in bulk through a giant CAT scan machine? What's it look like?
Let me just say something first of all about anthrax spores. We tend to think of them as almost immortal because we have found them in soil, for example, in Australia, 140 years after an event.
An event like a rotting carcass?
Exactly. An animal's dying, and then 140 years later, you find the anthrax spore
right
there.
So you mean scientists think of them as almost immortal, not just uninformed public?
The reason we developed the spores as a weapon is because they are tough. And we have to look at their toughness. And so one of the things that you can do is basically give them a blast of radiation, and that basically kills them off or can kill them off. They're also sensitive to sunlight. There are other things they're sensitive to. They're not sensitive to heat or cold.
So I don't know how familiar you are with the mechanics of irradiation, but is it feasible that we could put all of U.S. mail through an irradiation treatment before it was delivered or somewhere in the midst of the delivery?
Well, you're looking at major changes in terms of how we handle mail. Of course, anything is possible. I mean, we're a relatively wealthy country, aren't we? And we could do these things, but it would take a great reformation in terms of the whole process of distributing mail.
And even then, there'd be the issue of the spores that were floating in a system that would escape the irradiation machine, let's say.
Well, I think if you treated the mail beforehand that in some way at some depot, that you might be able to address that problem. But again, you know, we're looking at technological fixes, aren't we? All the way along, we're saying we can find some technology and it's going to solve the problem. But the problem is that it's a biological weapon, and that we invested in this biological weapon over two decades.
When you say we, you mean?
The United States laid the path for this very, very dangerous kind of threat to all of us.
Well, so our own weapons program has a role in this.
It's a blowback.
Blowback. We'll talk with Gene Gilman more after the break about anthrax in the U.S. Postal Service, how we can get rid of it, the environment that brought it there in the first place, and what the future looks like. She's talking about a great reform of the system possibly being necessary, but it's a system that's already struggling under almost $15 billion in debt. What do you think? How much more are you ready to pay for safe mail? Are you looking at your holiday mail differently this year? Have you cut down on your holiday mailings? We're talking about anthrax and the U.S. Postal System. You can call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to special coverage from WBUR Boston. This is special coverage from WBUR in Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the U.S. Postal Service tonight and the anthrax that it's struggling with in Washington, in New York, in Florida, and who knows where else. It appears to be a limited exposure so far, but the cost to creating a system that could deal with this over time would be enormous. Our guest is Jean Gilman. She's a senior fellow at the MIT Security Studies Program and a professor of sociology at Boston College. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Are you leaving an extra tip for your postman this year? They didn't sign up for this. Jean Gilman, you mentioned just before the break that this was weaponized anthrax that the U.S. had a role in creating in the first place. Just in a nutshell, tell us where this came from.
Well, this kind of anthrax came out of a program that we began during World War II and then continued throughout the 50s and up until 1969 when President Nixon re-announced the program. And it was during that time that anthrax, which was initially known as Agent N, was developed to be put into an aerosol so that aerosol could be used against enemy soldiers. But also there we had plans of using this anthrax against civilians as well. That was part of the program.
So in the 70s, it was put to rest, but somehow the spores were not all destroyed.
This is true. We kept on with what was called a defensive program, not to make weapons, but certainly to test our vaccines and masks and other kinds of equipment.
And today the White House said that it looks like there's a domestic source indeed for the anthrax that we're struggling with right now. I don't know if you saw that, but Ari Fleischer said, although people also pointed out that the original supply came from the Agriculture Department and it had been shared with labs in the U.S., Canada, and Britain. So the U.S. might not currently be the only source of this anthrax. Is that right?
That's right, yes. Porton Down over in the United Kingdom, and we have, I think, four or five other labs here where they're now narrowing it down.
We're talking about anthrax and the postal system tonight. We're all struggling with this right now at the holiday time. We're sending mail and receiving mail, and we want to, and it's something we need to do to communicate with friends and family. But how do we create a system that can deal with the threat of an anthrax weapon? How much more are you ready to pay for safe mail? We're joined now by Bob Cannon. He's Public Affairs Officer for Eastern and Central Massachusetts for the U.S. Postal Service. Good evening, Bob Cannon.
Good evening, Tom.
Thanks for joining us.
Good to be here.
Bob, can you give us some sense of what steps the Postal Service is taking in its systems, in technology, in procedures to deal with the threat that is now there for postal workers and the public?
Well, you spent the beginning part of the show obviously talking about the most, the one that's received the most attention. And it's called by various names, sanitization equipment or irradiation equipment. Of course, it is being used selectively right now, but very selectively, being used on for all the federal agencies located in Washington, D.C., for some selected customers in New York City and in New Jersey, basically in areas that have been very directly affected by anthrax in the mail, meaning letters that actually contain anthrax. The Postal Service is obviously still looking into purchasing much more of that equipment, but we've basically had to take more of a hard look at it than we thought we had to do initially back in October because of the effects on all the mail that go through the system. We want the mail to be safe, but we don't want to destroy the mail in the process.
Is it really feasible, Bob, that we could ever irradiate all the U.S. mail?
It's probably feasible, but there's probably a price to be paid. If we were going to go to that step, it's hard to envision doing that without slowing the mail down.
And speaking of slowing down the mail, have you seen any difference in mail volume this year? Are people's concerns about the mail translating into less and fewer letters and packages being sent?
Well, at this time of the year, we generally, when we think in terms of Christmas volumes, we measure our Christmas volumes by counting the postmarks, the number of postmark cancellations that we do daily. For instance, here in the Boston General Mail facility, we've been postmarking about 10% fewer letters through this Christmas season since Thanksgiving than we did last year.
Mm-hmm.
But it's difficult to tell what the reason is. If trying to find any evidence is very anecdotal.
Could just be the economy, I suppose.
And we think that the primary reason is the economy, because there was a drop-off in mail volume significantly before September 11th. There was another significant drop-off after September 11th, but before the anthrax period, so to speak, when a lot of businesses simply closed down for part of September and took the better part of a month or two to get up and running again, and some of them are not up to full speed. Well, when businesses are not up and running, one of the things they cut back on is mail.
And what about the postal workers, Bob Cannon? They're, of course, suddenly on the front line in this thing. Have there been any new steps taken to protect them? Is there anything you can really do?
Well, basically, those procedures are pretty low tech. We've provided all our mail processing employees with sanitary gloves to wear and provided them with surgical masks, protective masks. But it's optional. We haven't made it mandatory. And as a result, quite honestly, the majority of employees have chosen not to do that.
Mm-hmm.
If you're not used to wearing gloves or a mask to do your daily work, they are cumbersome. They're a little bit uncomfortable. They're probably not too aesthetically pleasing to on your face or your hands. So most employees are kind of thinking that they don't have to go to that step.
Avoiding that. And then there's talk of vaccinating postal employees, perhaps thousands of them. Would that just be around Washington again, or would it be nationally?
No, I think the talk of that right now is for employees in Brentwood and Trenton, New Jersey, that already on the front lines of the anthrax war, so to speak, and were already put on antibiotics and are coming to the end of their 60-day period. So now the consideration is being given to vaccinate them.
Now, all this is coming in a time when the Postal Service is already operating at a huge deficit and struggling under a big debt burden, and everything we're talking about costs money. What kind of cost-cutting measures have you had to take at the same time, Bob Cannon?
A lot of operational procedures have been changed. We've reorganized a good portion of our management structure, consolidated operations, which has resulted in at least hundreds of positions basically being eliminated, will probably lead to thousands at some point. Changes to our transportation network. Earlier March of this year, we literally put a freeze or moratorium on all capital building projects, which means building new post office facilities or relocating post offices. In 1 year, that's a savings of about $1 billion.
But of course, all this equipment is capital spending as well,
exactly.
And when you install it.
But it also means that there's a price to be paid there, too. Buildings
right.
get older and so forth, and you reach a point where you have to make a decision whether to keep a post office open or closed.
Bob, what about cuts in holiday temporary workers in the New England area around Boston? In Detroit, we read that they're down 40% this year from 1,100 to 700 because they just can't afford to bring on the extra staff to help sort the holiday mail.
That's partly the reason, but the other part of the reason is the drop off in mail volumes that we were already experiencing, as I said, before September 11th. So we have to begin the hiring process for our temporary workers during the Christmas period in September, because they go through the same hiring and screening procedures that our full-time employees do when they're hired. So that's why it has to begin early. At that time, it was decided that we'd hire fewer because of what we were seeing with the volume drop-off. Along
right.
came September 11th, and it just made it more evident.
And what about the speed of mail delivery this season, Bob Cannon? Any change?
Except for those areas directly affected, Washington, D.C., the mail going to the federal agencies, mail going to selected parts of New York City, really, no, there isn't any change because there is not large-scale sanitizing or irradiating going on with the mail, except for in those parts.
Mm-hmm. Bob Cannon, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
Bob Cannon is Public Affairs Manager for the U.S. Post Office in Eastern and Central Massachusetts. Gene Gilman, there you hear. It sounds like at this point in this region, the main and little used response is surgical gloves and surgical masks for weaponized anthrax. Do those have any utility?
Oh, sure. They have great utility.
Mm-hmm.
I think what the response is on the part of the workers, I think, is quite sensible. We have not been generally targeted. There have
right.
been very specific targets in these postal attacks. So you can't expect everyone in every post office in the United States to basically gear up for an attack.
As a as an epidemiologist, when you look at this, do you see a possibility of solving this through procedures and technology, or can we only solve it if we win the war on terrorism?
Well, I think we're going to take it on multiple fronts. Mm-hmm. We have terrific technology. We're doing very advanced things now in the study of anthrax, which will probably lead to a better vaccine. We have better antibiotics coming down the line. The post office will work out its prophylactic issues. I'm certain about this kind of attack and other things. But there is the broader issue of what are we doing internationally to stop biological weapons from being developed.
We have callers who want to join the conversation. Let's turn to them. We're talking about anthrax and the U.S. Postal Service. It's putting a burden on an already burdened system. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. Kim is on the line. Hi, Kim. You're on the air.
Thank you.
Sure.
Thanks for taking my call.
Good to have you.
In spite of what your previous speakers have said, mm-hmm. I have noticed in the capacity that I'm serving right now, which is managing the UNICEF holiday card shop
okay.
in Brookline.
Is business up or down?
Business is great. Business is wonderful. And
so that means people are buying cards.
People are buying cards, and they're buying lots of cards. And we have a kiosk over at the Holyoke Center at Harvard, and our business has been booming. We have not been able to keep up with the pace.
Well, that's maybe an irony here, that there is some increased risk. On the other hand, it's a time when people want to reach out and be in touch with family and friends.
I think that that's what we're seeing. And I think that I haven't really heard, other than fairly early on, we opened the Monday, October 29th, before Halloween.
Mm-hmm.
Fairly early on, I heard a couple of people who said, well, I'm sending postcards because of the mail. But I have not heard anything in the past several weeks at all. And as I say, my impression is that people who haven't typically sent cards regularly are sending cards, and people who send cards are making sure that they do it, and maybe are doing it even more so because they want to reach out and be in touch with people that are important to them.
Kim, thanks for your report from the front line there. Gene Gilman, I guess in some way what we see here is that people are actually pretty good judges of the real risk to them individually in this circumstance.
I think they are, and I think the important thing that we have to do now is work on information coming from the government and information particularly coming from the Army. The Army is our best source of information, by the way, about anthrax vaccine and anthrax research, and there has to be a lot more information coming from them as a public service.
They've been sitting on it? They know about it but aren't talking about it?
Well, you have to understand our weapons programs are basically secret programs, and anthrax has been part of the defensive weapons program. So I wouldn't say they've been sitting on it, but I would say that they have not been perhaps as forthcoming as they could have been.
Secret programs, but we're all part of it now. We're talking about the U.S. Postal Service and the anthrax threat there. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. How much more are you ready to pay for safe mail? And are you looking at your holiday mail differently this year? We're joined now by Nick Kulish. He's a reporter with the Wall Street Journal. He's written extensively on the U.S. Postal Service. Good evening, Nick Kulish.
How are you doing tonight?
We're well. Thanks a lot for joining us. Nick Kulish, we know that the Postal Service has never been flush with cash. It's got a big debt and a big deficit most years. How is it coping with the new demands being made on it by the anthrax threat?
Well, I mean, they're in an extremely difficult position over there. They just posted a $1.7 billion net loss for fiscal 2001, and they're expecting in 2002 to hit their third year in the red. The problem that they face is that they increase rates too much, then they lose volume.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, they can't expect a real bailout from Congress. So they're sort of squeezed on all sides and facing an uphill battle.
So Nick, what kind of steps is the post office taking to try and cut costs?
Well, you've seen, as was mentioned earlier in the show, you've seen serious cutbacks in part-time and temporary workers this holiday season.
Mm-hmm.
You've seen reductions in staff at headquarters. They reduced the number of officers, so-called officers at headquarters, by 20% and eliminated another 800 positions there. They've been, I guess you could say, discouraging overtime or granting less overtime to their full-time employees.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, many of their costs are fixed. They have they have a very difficult time, or in most cases it's impossible for them to lay off workers. They also face...
You've written that they're the biggest employer in the country after Walmart.
After Walmart, that's correct. But Walmart...
800,000?
Over 800,000. Walmart, however, can close unprofitable stores, but mm-hmm. the Postal Service is obliged to serve all addresses and to give people addresses for free.
38,000 postal offices around the country, and you've written about half of them don't cover their costs.
Right, right. But in some cases, that's an instance where a post office is delivering lots of mail, say, to a residential area, and could never hope to sell as many stamps as it's delivering. But for many of them, for rural areas especially, if the Postal Service was a private company that was operating purely out of profit, they would have closed a lot of the rural routes by now.
Nick Kulish, what kind of steps is the Postal Service taking that that citizens might see or feel?
Well, this is still somewhat under debate. You know, earlier this year they began to investigate just on a very basic level to do some studies on cutting back on Saturday service in some areas, and the uproar from Congress was tremendous. So they are in a position where it's very difficult, but they're thinking about closing some retail windows.
That means regular post office windows?
Regular post office windows. Mm-hmm. So this isn't to say that you wouldn't receive your mail, mm-hmm. but you couldn't necessarily go and buy stamps and drop things off.
So on a Saturday.
Right, sort of a half measure. And at the same time, I think that the building freeze that's been in place for a while now, that was referred to again earlier in the show, that is something that really will affect people. I mean, if someone out there finds themselves standing in lines all the way out the door, part of the reason is that there should probably be another post office in his or her area, but just hasn't been built. Crowley County, Colorado, for instance, mm-hmm. was the fastest growing county according to the U.S. Census between 1990 and 2000. Well, that's one of the places that's been forced to wait for a new post office branch.
And Nick Kulish, you write for the Wall Street Journal. You're probably aware of the private delivery services as well. Is this an opportunity for them, or are they facing the same problems the post office is?
Well, what's interesting is
FedEx, UPS, I guess.
The biggest, overseas postal services mm-hmm. try to compete in certain ways. But what's interesting is the postal service's greatest problems stem from areas that the private companies have no desire to get into, such as those rural routes. So they can sort of content themselves with the very high yield, express delivery kind of things, or parcel deliveries, and leave the unprofitable stuff to the post office, which has a congressional mandate to do it.
Gene Gilman, you're an epidemiologist and a sociologist. How would you like to be head of the U.S. Postal Service?
Oh,
right
I think
now?
That's a job I really don't want.
It sounds like a tall, tall order. Nick, do you get the feeling that they're just throwing up their hands, or are they going to be looking for more money for higher postal rates?
Well, I'm sure they haven't just thrown up their hands. They are professionals, but they have. What's interesting, on September 11th, actually, they made public on the morning of September 11th, before the news had really spread, they made public their request for a 3-cent increase, which is fairly steep, and that, mind you, is before the anthrax. And before they knew about the costs to their physical infrastructure in New York, for instance.
So it may be bigger. Nick Kulish, hold there. We've got to take a short break here. We're talking with Nick Kulish, a staff reporter at the Wall Street Journal, and Gene Gilman, a senior fellow at the MIT Security Studies Program, about anthrax and the U.S. Postal Service. You can join the conversation. Have you cut down on your holiday mailings, or are you mailing full bore? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to Special Coverage from WBUR Boston. This is Special Coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're looking tonight at the U.S. Postal Service and the anthrax threat. It's the holiday season. Everybody's mailing and receiving mail, but we know there's a thread of risk running through all of it now. How will the U.S. Postal Service and the country ultimately deal with that risk? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. Are you working for the post office? Are you happy when you see the mail show up this year? Don is on the line. Welcome, Don. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
I'm very concerned that the conversation has focused a lot
at various points on the use of irradiation as a means of controlling anthrax in the mail.
Is there a better answer, Don? We're all looking for one.
I think there is, and the CDC actually posted it on their website back on October 31st.
Okay.
They emphasized the use of engineering controls in mail handling. And by engineering controls, they mean, first of all, one thing that the post office has been doing in most of its facilities, which is to stop blowdown and to use HEPA-filtered, that is, high-efficiency filtration vacuum cleaners.
Don, define your terms for us a little bit. Blowdown and high-filtration vacuum, you're saying that in the sorting equipment, they want less air puffing around and they want to...
That's right. The traditional way of cleaning the paper, just like in your laser printer and photocopy machine, you get all that little bit of fine paper buildup.
Mm-hmm.
And the post office has a big problem with this because they're processing an awful lot of paper.
Right.
So they clean machines historically by going in with compressed air,
mm-hmm.
blowing that paper out. And they probably, in the facilities where they had the letters with anthrax, blew around a lot of the anthrax spores that way. So they've stopped that. They're using vacuum cleaners, and that's a big first step. But the CDC recommended a couple of other things.
Okay.
They said that they should use local exhaust ventilation at pinch roller areas. They should use high-efficiency filtered exhaust hoods in areas where dust is generated. They should use air curtains using laminar flow.
So, Don, if I follow the gist of these steps, they would protect postal workers from anthrax spores more effectively, and they might prevent the spread of anthrax from letter to letter, but this wouldn't knock the anthrax out of an envelope where it was nesting, waiting to be delivered.
That's correct. But it would not introduce another toxic agent to the workplace either.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it would also protect the Postal Service itself from these other threats that could be put in the mail.
Mm-hmm. You mean other than anthrax?
Other than biological-ish agents.
Right. Don, thanks for your call. Let me put this heaping platter up to Gene Gilman. There's a different kind of strategy here, which is just containing whatever's in the mail within the postal workplace.
Well, in Brentwood and also down in Trenton, they stopped that cleaning the way they had been doing it, which was just further dispersing spores, obviously. There's probably things, you can do in the workplace to improve the air quality all the way around. So it's unfortunate, but it's probably true that people working in the post office maybe were inhaling a whole lot of other bad things.
As well.
I wouldn't want to be asthmatic in working for the post office.
I guess not. Nick Kulish with the Wall Street Journal, have you paid attention at all to this debate over the mechanics of how it ought to be addressed, irradiation versus controlling the air and filtering the air better within postal facilities?
Well, the plan at the outset was to do both. The Postal Service, that is, immediately announced that they were going to switch to the vacuum systems rather than the compressed air. And when, back when they thought they might get a pretty significant bailout from Congress, they hoped at the same time to set up irradiation technologies at their distribution centers and try to irradiate as much of the mail as possible. So, I mean, it was always seen as sort of a multi-pronged approach with the gloves and the masks, as we discussed,
right.
Vacuum equipment, as well as something along the lines of irradiation or chlorine dioxide fumigation.
And in economic terms, Nick, is it conceivable that this could be applied nationwide in all postal facilities at some point, or is this always going to be just for Washington and a few strategic locations?
Well, I mean, at this point, it's not something that they can afford. I mean, the Postal Service is up near its congressionally mandated debt ceiling. As we said, they're already expecting a loss for 2002 and had a multi-billion dollar loss in 2001. When Postmaster General Potter went before the Senate Appropriations Panel to request money, he said that new safety equipment would come somewhere around $3 to $4 billion. On the same day, Ari Fleischer, White House spokesman, said they'd have to make do with the $175 million they'd been originally offered until next year's budget process. So, I mean, something would have to change in order for them to be able to do this, and it's not something that they can afford to do simply with rate increases.
So, essentially, we're just biting the bullet here, and, of course, that means postal workers. Most of all, we're at 1-800-423-8255. You can join the conversation. Bobby's calling from Buffalo, New York. Welcome, Bobby. You're on the air.
Yes, I wanted to call in to mention two things now that I think of it. My brother works for the Postal Service, and where he works at, they started the vacuuming, but they shut down all the HEPA filters, and there's a lot of dust and what he terms brown lung possibilities, because there's no filtering of air at all because they're afraid of the air blowing the spores around.
That the filtering itself would create more movement of spores if they were there.
Correct, but the problem is you have all that dust that, if you have a printer, you know, as the gentleman mentioned, that you have all this fine powdery stuff that you inhale that too long, you get brown lungs.
So that means actually poorer air quality than before, Bobby. Is that what you're saying?
Considerably. Yeah. The other thing is, imagine working for an outfit that will gladly test dogs' noses for anthrax and let two people die.
What do you mean by that, Bobby?
Well, the dogs in New York, Washington, D.C., they tested those dogs for anthrax, but they didn't test the people for anthrax, and two people died.
What about that? Is your brother and his colleagues, are they feeling taken care of here or not? I guess that answers that.
Long-term employees never felt well taken care of, but, it's an amazing place to work, apparently. Thank God I don't work there, but... that's the kind of mentality. Treat the dogs, but, you're okay. Wear the mask, you're okay. And then two guys died. That's a mentality that's running the place. But that's all I had to mention.
Bobby, thanks very much for your call. It's maybe the most important first angle to be taking here. And Gene Gilman, what about it? I mean, the postal workers are now right there exposed to this. And we're hearing we don't have the financial ability to put the machinery in to protect them right away. So what do we do? Is it reasonable? Is it humane to expect them to keep sorting the mail?
Well, I think they have to keep sorting the mail, but I think what we're looking at is a foretaste of what the whole war against terrorism on the domestic front is going to look like. That is, we have great plans and we're going to protect everyone, but in fact the money's not there. So you do have to look at targets. You have to look at not every post office, but the Capitol Post Office or the New York Post Office or something like that. I think we're in the model here is becoming more and more explicit.
Boy, that's no fun if you're working in the post office in Buffalo or Boston or somewhere that's not it being protected with everything we can do. Natalie's on the line. Welcome, Natalia. You're on the air.
Hello. I have a different question.
Fire away.
I would like to ask, but I wanted just to say something about what was just said.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me that we're spending an awful lot of money on military exercises, and justifiably so. I have no quarrel with it. But I don't see why these things can't come under our military budget, which is pretty big, and would easily grow bigger, far more easily than extra money for the post office as simply the post office.
Natalia, we'll hold that question and we'll put it to Nick Kulish. Was there another part to your question?
Yes. What I actually called about was to ask... and it's been partially answered, but I'm still not clear on it.
Okay.
I heard that radiation is being used to sterilize and also wondered about x-rays. I send out, along with millions of other people, I'm sure, homemade baked goods at Christmas to my faraway relatives. And I don't know if they're going to get there in an edible state. Or if it's, say, is it okay to send a bread, but I shouldn't send something with frosting on it, or you know what I mean?
I'm sure you're not the only one thinking about that tonight, and I thank you for that.
Also, part two of that question is, if they're x-raying packages to see what they contain, is a foil wrap around something going to cause them to have to open my package?
Okay, Natalia, we got the nitty-gritty here. I think the x-rays are not really about examining what's inside in this case, but isn't it related to irradiation, Gene Gilman?
Yes. There's all sorts of concerns, and that's why you don't find the irradiation being promoted quite so generally. There are warnings that have to go out to tell people, don't send this in the mail,
can people send food in the mail and feel confident that it will be healthy for the recipients?
It might be actually a bit more healthy than they had had initially planned because it destroys bacteria.
And many foods are actually irradiated, right?
Well, that's right. There has been a whole social movement for the irradiation of fruits and vegetables, for example, as a way of getting rid of bacteria that otherwise can cause disease.
So to Natalia's question, is there any increased danger this season in putting food in the mail?
I wouldn't think this particular season, but if they move more generally to irradiation, the guidelines will have to go out and we'll have to think more seriously about them.
Well, but it wouldn't, as you're describing it, it wouldn't make it more dangerous if they irradiated more generally.
Not for those Christmas cookies, I wouldn't think.
Mm-hmm. And Nick Kulish, what about Natalia's other point? Is there any other budget, a national security budget, that might be tapped here for the post office?
Well, I think that was what the post office was hoping when they went up to Capitol Hill. They were hoping that this would be considered something part of Homeland Defense or Homeland Security. But unfortunately, that wasn't the case. I mean, the $175 million that they have received was part of emergency appropriations for that kind of thing. So, I mean, as of right now, you know, there's no money for them coming from any kind of military budget. But I think that it will depend a lot on what we see going forward. If the anthrax attacks remain something isolated, then I think that people will sort of assume that it's something that we can let slide, if you will. If they start up again, if they appear more indiscriminate, then I think that the pressure would rise significantly on legislators to do something about it.
So it's interesting, Nick Kulish. It means you're saying essentially that we're relying on the non-attack of potential attackers here.
Well, I mean, if you look at, for instance, the Unabomber case, it took years to catch someone, and that was only after the Unabomber began sending out manifestos describing, you know, why he was doing what he was doing. I've found in conversations that I've had with postal inspectors, as of right now, there isn't that much optimism. I mean, they're hoping to catch this person through there at the source of the anthrax, but I mean, tracing someone back to Trenton, New Jersey isn't very helpful when they could have driven there from Cleveland to drop the letter in the mailbox.
And Gene Gilman, do you agree that in some sense we're now relying on the good graces of potential terrorists not to send out more of this?
Well, I think we have to – I'm a bit more optimistic, actually, about catching the perpetrator. I feel that there is a good detective hunt going on here. Mm-hmm. I think the FBI is out doing its interviews, and the scientists are certainly looking at things even like the aging or the age of the samples. I mean, they're getting into the very fine details of this kind of detective work. So I am more optimistic that we'll find the perpetrator.
But it sounds like ultimately it depends on – it's, in some sense, winning a war on terror. If we live in a world of terror, it's going to be hard to stop every gap in the system here.
That's right. It's going to be very, very difficult, especially the domestic part of our efforts against terrorism. They are changing our lives, actually.
Gene Gilman, thanks a lot for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Gene Gilman is a senior fellow at the MIT Securities Study Program and a professor of sociology at Boston College. And Nick Kulish, thank you very much for coming on.
Thank you.
Nick Kulish is a staff reporter with the Wall Street Journal. He's written extensively about the Postal Service. You can continue this conversation online. Go to WBUR.org and click on Special Coverage Forums. You won't be the only one there talking about the U.S. Postal Service and anthrax. As the anthrax attacks changed how the post office handles mail this holiday season, the terror attacks and the war in Afghanistan have also changed what people are writing in holiday letters this year. Friends and family of Barbara Beck and Robert Bonn of Watertown, Massachusetts, are receiving a different type of holiday message.
Dear friends and family, this has been such a challenging and unusual year that recounting the usual family events, other than to say that we are all in good health, doesn't feel quite right. I stopped reading the funnies on September 11th and now read only A Nation Challenged in the New York Times. Over dinner, we talk about hubris and how it is that humans can believe in the superiority of their religion or culture over that of another's. But I was recently heartened by a newspaper photograph taken shortly after the fall of Kabul. The photograph showed four men on bicycles carrying large numbers of gossamer-colored balloons against that tan-gray, monochromatic background that has come to represent Afghanistan. The men were wearing expressions of great joy, as balloons had been forbidden by the Taliban. I thought that if the balloon vendors can return to Kabul, then there is hope indeed. Wishing you all well this holiday season, Barbara and Robert.
Barbara Beck and Robert Bonn live in Watertown, Massachusetts. We'd like to hear from you. Send your submissions by email. The address is special@wbur.org. You can read or listen to other radio diaries on our website. Log on to WBUR.org and click on Special Coverage. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to Special Coverage from WBUR in Boston.
This is WBUR.